This is for you, Kings fans, wherever you may be. All the frustration and disappointment of the past is gone. The 45-year drought is over. The Los Angeles Kings are indeed the Kings of the National Hockey League. They are the 2012 Stanley Cup champions.
Cleared away by the Kings, picked up by Martinez. Martinez to Clifford, feeds it right side to Foley with a shot. Save, rebound, score! Alec Martinez has won the Stanley Cup for the Los Angeles Kings, and royalty reigns again in the NHL.
Hey, what's up, Kings fans, and welcome to the Hockey Royalty Podcast, the official podcast of HockeyRoyalty.com. I'm Scott Kinville, and before we get going, I want to let you know that you can find us on social media. You can find us on Facebook at the Hockey Royalty Podcast, and you can also find us at Hockey_Royalty and at Royalty_Pod, and those are both on Twitter. I kind of screwed that up. Sorry about that. But anyways, we got a great show lined up for you, and before we bring our guest in, I'm going to bring in my co-host. So I'm going to let you know that Russ is not here just yet. He'll be here in the second part, but he's not here right now. But as always, riding shotgun with me is the editor of HockeyRoyalty.com. He is our Shakespeare. He is our Pulitzer Prize winner, if you will. He is the one. He is the only. He's Mr. Ryan Sykes. What's going on, buddy?
Hey, Scott. It's been a little while since we've gotten together. How are you
doing? I know. We almost forgot what each other's voices sounded like.
I call your voicemail sometimes and then hang up. just to hear it.
Well, I got to remember to change the message then. Oh, man, that's too much. Like I said, Russ is going to join us in the second half. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring our guest. Our guest is the author of Hockey 365, Daily Stories from the Ice. He's a hockey historian. He's also a contributor for the LA Kings. He is Mr. Mike Comito. Mike, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
So how you been? All right?
Yeah, I'm holding up. You know, it's, I guess, officially the last day of August when we're talking. So, I mean, I was saying to my staff this week that it's in our world, it's the last week of summer because then next week the new semester starts up. So it was a little, a little disappointing to phrase it in that way, but I can't complain. Everything's going well up here in Sudbury. So I'm looking forward to the new school year and the new hockey season coming up.
That's right. You're in Sudbury, Ontario.
I am. Yeah. 4 hours north of Toronto. So weather is still nice right now, but that's probably going to change in about 6 weeks or so. It's going to start to cool off.
And Mike, when I reached out to you a couple weeks ago to come on the pod, you said you were getting away to the cottage for a bit. Does everyone in Canada have a cottage?
I wish. I don't have a cottage. We were fortunate enough to have friends that have cottages. So we went to, we were in Quebec, just on the other side of Ottawa, okay, for a few days. Our friends have a place up there, and it was probably the first place I've been to since February of 2020, about a 6-hour drive away, but it felt like to be in another planet because no cell service there. So I was completely off the grid and it was just really nice to unplug for a few days and get away from Zoom and get away from Teams and all that stuff.
Yeah. Sometimes it's nice to unplug. I tell these guys here, you know, I'm going to be on vacation, unplug, and I'm still responding to messages, still writing articles, you know, for my phone.
Oh, yeah. I've done a few staycations this summer. And yeah, unless you're willing to take email off your phone, like people can get a hold of you. They can call you. Yeah. They can track you down. And even if they don't think they're making you think about work, you know, you're thinking about work, right? So mm-hmm. At least you got to go out in the bush and leave your devices behind.
So, Mike, I got to ask you, just tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into kind of just obviously a lot of people that follow you on Twitter know that you kind of, you post multiple things throughout the day of what happened, you know, on this day. Talk about how you find that and tell us about you.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, I've always loved hockey since I was a kid. I never played at an organized level. My mom likes to joke that we didn't put me in because she thought it was too dangerous, but we did move around a lot when I was a kid. So I think that's partly the reason, maybe the reason my mom said, but I got to play on like backyard rinks and neighborhood rinks and things like that. So I always enjoyed it. And then I always enjoyed the history in general, right? So then I got into the history of hockey, loved collecting hockey cards, loved learning about the stories of the players. Some of my favorite cards that I had as a kid were actually like the hockey cards of the trophies, to learn, you know, why the Lady Bing was called the Lady Bing and the history behind that, and, you know, the Art Ross and all that stuff. So I think from an early age, I was drawn to history. I eventually got into that, you know, as my academic pursuit. I went to ended up getting a PhD in Canadian history, but I focused on environmental history. And while I was doing my my graduate work, I started to realize that the skills I was developing, you know, as a historian, were transferable to hockey. I'd always, you know, been interested in reading about hockey and in reading stories about hockey, but I never pictured myself having a role in that world. But I started to think that, hey, there's plenty of hockey history out there. You know, I think I can maybe use the skills I've been developing, but apply them to tell hockey history for a more popular audience and not necessarily an academic audience like the way that I've been doing. And so really, I just kind of got into it from there. I started just blogging for myself. Eventually, some opportunities came up. And as a historian, I found that, you know, among my group of environmental historians, I think we were pretty early adopters of Twitter. I got on Twitter in 2011, maybe just a few years after it launched. And, you know, it was a great platform for historians to connect and share work. But I also noticed there was obviously a burgeoning hockey community there. And I kind of thought that, you know, with my background, hockey history made sense. You know, I admired the work that Jen Conway, aka NHL History Girl, had been doing. I just tried to put my own spin on it. I started doing that, probably 6 years ago. And in honestly, the way that I initially got into it was that the Hockey Hall of Fame used to have a historic generator where you'd go onto their websites and you would punch in a day and you would hit go, and it would give you, it would spit out all the dates, you know, that, or all the significant moments that happened on that date. So I started mining that, using that for my Twitter. And then, you know, I kind of got further along, started doing my own research, you know, taking what I could see from NHL.com and other websites and kind of putting that together, pulling stuff out of books I'd read. I'd bookmark stuff, go back, write out, that's a date that I want to remember. And honestly, I think the best resource I had was that the Hockey Hall of Fame had a back-end website that populated that generator. And I was talking to a fellow who runs the St. Louis Blues history Twitter feed. And I think that day I shared with him, you know, a piece of Blues history. And he's like, well, I already know about that. Do you know about this website? So he shared with me this link where if you punch in any day, it'll have a list like this long of everything that happened that day, from birthdays, you know, to any kind of transaction, any big game stuff. It stops at the just before the 2004-05 lockout. But it was just a gold mine because you could just change the number, you know, in the address bar of the date, and then it would just keep giving you this information. So I just slowly built, you know, my own archive on Twitter. And so now I think I've built up a pretty good database. So every year I'm just kind of going back through it, you know, rescheduling all those old tweets and then finding new ones as obviously the seasons get updated. But yeah, like that was honestly the biggest thing for me, was being able to have access to that raw data. The funny thing was, though, is that that guy, I guess he considers me a competitor, he since blocked me. I don't see any of his tweets on, you know, St. Louis Blues history, or he's got another hockey magazine feed. I'm blocked on that too. So I don't, him and I started off pretty collegially, but obviously something happened along the way, and I'm no longer privy to those tweets. So it's all good though.
Oh man, that's too bad.
Yeah.
Well, is he verified?
I don't know. I mean, maybe he is. I haven't been able to see him for a few years. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. So, I mean, yeah, maybe I said something, but otherwise, credit to him. He helped me out in a big way. So,
yeah,
for whatever reason, we went astray.
Mike, I know we'll get to it in a little bit, but you are a contributor to the LA Kings in some capacity. But do you have a favorite team?
I mean, I'd be lying if I said anything other than the Maple Leafs. I was born into being a Maple Leafs fan. My mom's a huge Leafs fan. So I think, you know, she's a big hockey fan. And so she ultimately got me into the Leafs. You know, I have memories of watching the playoff runs in the early 90s. So, you know, I was a big Doug Gilmore, Wendell Clark fan growing up. Obviously, we still talk about the missed high stick call in 93. Not that, you know, I think I've come around to accepting what happened, that they had other opportunities to close out that series after that. So it can't all be chalked up to that call. But yeah, that, you know, that is my favorite team. Obviously, I think with the work that I've done for the Kings over the last 3 years, they obviously have a place in my heart. I think I've, you know, been fortunate enough to be able to cover the team's history in such a way that I'm kind of invested, you know, in the current product on the ice. A lot of my stories don't really focus on what the team is currently doing, but I think I have to, you know, at least in a cursory fashion, keep up with what the team is doing, whether it's moves the front office is making or, you know, trying to catch as many games as I can. But certainly I think whatever happens, you know, if I end up writing for the Kings for the next, you know, 5 years or I finish in the next 5 months, I'll always look back, I think, pretty fondly and think about the Kings. You know, there's some local connections here in Sudbury as well with the Kings. And so I think that's always been kind of a reason why I was pretty, you know, pretty ecstatic when the opportunity came around in 2018. Obviously, I think the opportunity to contribute to any NHL team is something I would have jumped at 3 years ago. But it just so happens that I think there was a lot of synergies there, you know, between me and the Kings. And I think people of my age growing up with Wayne Gretzky. So obviously it was kind of a no-brainer, you know, for me to jump at that that chance when it came around.
Yeah, and obviously in 2018, the Kings were going through kind of a transitional period. Just kind of walk us through how the opportunity presented itself.
Yeah, so I mean, I go back and think about the role that Twitter and podcasting played with that. So the full story is that after I finished my PhD, I started emailing every NHL club and asking if they had you know, a team historian on their in their front office, or if, and if they didn't, are they looking for one? And I honestly got a responses from quite a few of the teams. I'd say the by and large, the majority of the league had got back to me in some capacity. And so I was on Jesse Cohen's All the Kings Men podcast. This mm-hmm. was in, yeah, the summer of 2018. And I reiterated that story about how, you know, I tried to get a gig as a team historian. It never worked out. Talked about, you know, how I'd reached out to all these various clubs. And then I went on Twitter and I repeated that story, you know, just by kind of putting a couple tweets together to kind of tell that the story about how I'd tried and failed to become a team historian. And the Kings, I guess, came upon that tweet. And so they replied to me and said, "We never got a message from you," which was not true. I did get a nice response from the Kings at the time, but I was obviously not going to say anything in the moment. So I just said, "No problem. Like, name the time. Happy to connect." And so we took the conversation offline, and you know, they obviously said that they had been following my work for a little bit with the history of stuff that I've been doing for Vice and Sports and other places like that, and were wondering if I was interested in doing similar type coverage, you know, for the team's website. And so that was in, you know, the summer of 2018, and I wrote my first piece for the team in October of 2018. And you know, now that at the time that we're talking right now, I've written over 50 stories for the Kings. So honestly, like, it might have come around in its, you know, organically at some point. They might have found me, but I honestly do credit, you know, I think early on too, I forgot this part, because I mean, the reason I was on Jesse's podcast is because I used to blog for the Royal Half. This is probably like 5 years ago, and they gave me an opportunity to, I think, kind of find my voice and, you know, figure out what I really wanted to write about. They took a chance and let me kind of write some weird stuff for the website. But, you know, that's, I think, in keeping with what the Royal Half did, and I think some of the, you know, some of the levity they brought to the sport. So I think having known some of those folks back in the day, you know, gave me the chance to go on Jesse's podcast when I did. You know, maybe, you know, the Kings were aware of stuff like that, but I think certainly being on social media and having the opportunities that I had to be on podcasts like Jesse's, I think, allowed me, I think, the stars kind of aligned and it all worked out.
Excellent. That's really cool. So tell us about your book. The book is called Hockey 365 Daily Stories from the Ice. So was that more kind of like just the genesis of everything that you had been working on?
Yes, it was pretty much, I think, kind of a culmination of the stuff that I was doing on Twitter and then the articles I've been writing for places like Vice. So this was the, you know, the season of 2016-17. I was writing quite regularly for Vice. And I was, you know, full on into the daily, you know, hockey history tweets. And halfway through the year, we were vacationing in Mexico and kind of, you know, I was sitting on a beach, you know, probably having a few too many cervezas, reading a hockey book. And I thought, you know what, like, this is the, I've been reading hockey books for as long as I can remember, especially in the last little while when I started writing again, I was just only reading hockey. And I thought, this is the type of book that I like to read. So this is the type of book that I would want to write. And at the time, I was under contract with University Press to take my PhD work and turn it into a book. I was just never getting started with that. I just didn't have the motivation to do it. I think I'd spent too many years researching the subject and just never thought I would actually get a tangible, like, outcome in my hands. And so on the way home from Mexico, I sketched an outline, kind of taking the stuff that I'd done already for Vice, kind of pairing it with a lot of those tweets I'd been doing. And I had an outline of a daily moment for every day of the year. And the original idea was having these longer essays and then having shorter stories in between. Once we kind of got rolling and I found a publisher, we agreed that I think that approach didn't make sense. And the novelty of one page per day per story was really the kind was the way to go. And so that's kind of how it took shape. That first book came out in 2018. So I've got the second book coming out now in just less than a month away. It comes out September 28th. And again, it's that one's the same format, Hockey 365, but the second period, but 365 brand new stories. I always say 365, but truly it is 366 because you've got to account for those leap years. But yeah, from a marketing perspective, Hockey 366, doesn't have the same ring.
So. Well, you got to be careful too, because next time it's going to be the third period, and then you'll be like the overtime, and now, the shootout. Shootout round two, Hockey 365.
Yeah, there's I think I'm definitely committed to doing the third period just to complete regulation, but you can go into so many different directions with, yeah, like overtime, sudden death, shootouts, you know. So we'll see, I guess, how this book does, how the third one does, and how long the publisher wants to kind of keep doing this. But there's certainly enough hockey history there out there to sustain, you know, several more volumes, that's for sure.
Yeah. Mike, you ever thought about converting like some fashion of your book into like one of those daily desk calendars where you rip off the day and it's like a, you know, the facts or whatever?
Yeah, I actually have, because I think that's kind of where, you know, probably some of the inspiration for this book came from. Because I think actually in the first book I talk about in the introduction how, like, I think of it as a word of the day calendar, mm-hmm. like in overdrive, because that's essentially the idea here, is that you kind of, when you go to work every day, you flip over the calendar. Although I've always had those, people would give them to me and then I would go into work, you know, 3 months had passed and you're still kind of like 3 months behind. So like I truthfully never really kind of got into those, but there's definitely appeal in those, and that's kind of where I thought, if those work and people like those word of the day calendars, then like same kind of approach here with a page a day. You know, you can pick it up and put it down. It's not a read where, you know, everything is linked throughout. Obviously, it's all part of hockey history, so they're all part of the same mesh. But you could certainly pick the book up today and then read a few pages and then kind of put it away for a few days, pick it up mm-hmm. again. And you're not necessarily having to, you know, remember where you're at, because each page starts a brand new story and they're all pretty much self-contained.
You know, and that's an ideal format, especially for somebody who's got a very short attention span like me. That would be that's awesome.
Yeah, no, people always say it's, you know, it's the perfect bathroom reader, but they kind of shy away when they tell me that, as if that's a bad thing. It's honestly a good thing. I mean, I think when, you know, when you're trying to come up with a concept of a book, I think your goal is to have people to read it. And so I think if people want to read it in the bathroom, I'm all for that. As long as somebody's, you know, I think I appreciate anybody who's willing to take, you know, their hard earned money and their time and spend it with my word. So wherever they want to do that is quite all right by me. And I'm more than happy to advocate for having Hockey 365, you know, as a bathroom reader.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I know you already do a podcast, but that actually might be like an interesting podcast idea, to take each of those, you know, stories and make them their own.
Yeah, I agree.
Four or five minute story.
Or even like, I'm probably going to get to it, Mike, but, you know, bring a guest in and, you know, accompany the story, encompass it, you know?
Yeah, no, and it's funny you guys say that, because we'd actually talked about that when the first book came out, about like doing an audio book, but rather than just doing a typical audio book, you know, maybe there is a way of packaging it as a podcast where you could do those. I could obviously read out a page and do that every day, or release them in chunks. But I think as a podcast, you could, yeah, certainly bring on a guest and kind of get into more details about, you know, this story is about you on this day, but obviously your career is much more than a page. And we can kind of talk about it from there. So we didn't end up doing that for the first book. It's certainly something I'm interested in. People have always told me that audiobooks are very difficult. You've got to spend a lot of time, you know, in the studio doing that. I certainly think that, especially for a book of this length, it would be a tall order. But I think a podcast might be a more you know, manageable format, and maybe just picking and choosing some of the moments from Hockey 365 rather than trying to tackle them all and what would end up being probably, like, I don't even know how many hours it would be, but it would be a pretty long audiobook.
And that's kind of a perfect segue to what I want to talk about next, is your Unlikely Innovators pod. You know, tell us how that kind of came to be, and just, I guess, what your goal of each episode is.
Yeah, I've obviously been interested in podcasts. I've been fortunate enough that people like you invite me on their podcast. So I've been doing that, you know, for a few years now. I've often thought about starting, you know, my own hockey podcast. I just never found the time. I think I was at, you know, writing has always been my focus, and so I've always thought of it like, if I started my own podcast, it would probably come at the expense of some of the writing I was doing. So it never was really a good time, you know, to start something new. But it was kind of always in the back of my mind. And then what I realized was that, you know, maybe, you know, hockey is not the way to go for me right now. Cause again, I was, you know, with my writing commitments and, you know, all the other stuff I wanted to do. I have a colleague that I work with and a friend of mine, Steve Gravel. We both work at Cambrian College and we were both, you know, big consumers of podcasts. We've often talked about, you know, could him and I do a podcast just based on some of the, you know, the ramblings we have, you know, with each other in the office. And we're like, well, no one's going to listen to that podcast, but what people might listen to is if it was about work and kind of highlighting, you know, the work that we do in the world of college applied research. And so, that was kind of where the idea came. It was this past summer, you know, we thought that maybe that would be a good way to highlight an interesting story, you know, that's happening in the world of college research and in the private sector in terms of R&D and innovation. And so him and I just kind of started doing it where we were focusing on different topics every week, you know, kind of going through the ins and outs of what college applied research is. But we really realized that I think for us to sustain the momentum, we had to start having on guests. And that was really that we were going to eventually get to that point anyway, because we called the show The Unlikely Innovators, because for a number of reasons, I think here in Canada, especially in Ontario, colleges are not seen as places where you would go for innovation or research. It's often the universities that are thought of as the bastions of research, but really colleges help companies innovate every day. But it's still kind of a best kept secret. And so we wanted to shine a light that colleges are not unlikely, you know, sources of innovation. Steve and myself kind of come from humanities backgrounds, but we work with a lot of companies who are focused on tech adoption. So in our own rights, we're unlikely innovators because we came from history and now we're working with companies who are trying to, you know, come up with new technologies to deploy underground and mining. And so that's kind of been the theme we've been following with our guests, is we like having on guests who are examples of unlikely innovators or unlikely entrepreneurs, kind of going through their story of, you know, how they came to be where they are. So we've been fortunate enough that, you know, we've been able to continue the podcast. I think that's probably one of the most, you know, challenging things that I'm sure you two can attest to, is just like, mm-hmm. once you started, like, how do you maintain it and keep the consistency going? So we've sure. been able to do an episode every week. We put it out. And yeah, I think it's just been a great way for us to hopefully promote the work that we're doing at Cambrian, and also highlight some of those cool stories that are happening, not only in our backyard, but I think, you know, beyond Sudbury and across Canada, and beyond there as well.
Man, that's fantastic. That really is. And, you know, I mean, obviously you are so much more than a hockey writer and historian, obviously, with that podcast. And you're also involved with a foundation, the NEO Kids Foundation, correct?
Yep.
Yeah. NEO Kids. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I got on board with NEO Kids, I guess formally, just this past year, as a member of the board of directors. But I've been a supporter of NEO Kids locally here in town. The whole purpose of NEO Kids is obviously just to kind of just a quick geography lesson here. Sudbury is about 4 hours north of Toronto, and obviously, you know, Toronto has a sick kids hospital, which is, you know, world renowned for its care, you know, mm-hmm. for kids and their families as well. But the thing here is in Northern Ontario, it's difficult for families to obviously make those trips down south to get the care, especially for extended periods of care. It often leaves a kind of family split apart. So the goal of NEO Kids is to help realize that goal of a specialized care facility that's available to families and kids in Northeastern Ontario. So not only Sudbury, but, you know, places like Timmins, North Bay, obviously those are much, like, Timmins is much farther away from Toronto than we are. It's about a, you know, 7-8 hour drive. So certainly it's difficult for those families in those parts of the region, you know, to get the care and attention that they need. And so it's obviously been a cause that's been near and dear to my heart. It's cliche to say it, but, you know, we had a scare when we were in Toronto, actually, and it just so happened that we were in a hotel that was just a block down from SickKids, and my daughter had an accident in the hotel, and we were able to go there, and the care that we received was honestly second to none, and it just made me, you know, feel so thankful to have access to something like that, you know, in that moment, just down the street. But obviously, if we were in Sudbury, you know, it might have been a different story. And so it made me, I think, a little bit more, you know, appreciative of places like that, and made me want to give back more locally to help ensure that families who are going through much more, you know, scary things than we did that day, especially mm-hmm. over long periods of time, that they deserve to have, you know, the proper care and attention that their kids need and close to home. And so I got involved with them. The interesting thing about NEO Kids is obviously Nick Foligno is a huge supporter of NEO Kids as well. His daughter Milana has obviously had her own struggles growing up. And so I think that he realized that the care that, you know, she's been getting, you know, in the United States is obviously, he sees the need for that in Northeastern Ontario as a good Sudbury boy. And so, you know, he's, I think the honorary chair of the board. So there's obviously some hockey connections there. Every year he does, this tournament called NHL versus Docs, where some of the doctors from the hospital would play against some NHL players. So Nick would usually bring in some of his teammates from Columbus. Now he'll obviously be, if he does it next year, it'll be maybe some teammates from Boston, you know, probably some former teammates from Columbus. His brother brings, you know, some players as well. And it's a great way for the fans to get some NHL action in August. So you get, you get some exciting games. Obviously we haven't been able to do that because of the pandemic, but I think he wants to do one last send off before, you know, before closing the chapter on that particular, that fundraiser. But yeah, all that to say, I know this has been a really long answer, but when the first book came out, you know, one of the things I wanted to do was try to obviously get the book into as many hands as I could, but also give back. So I did a fundraiser with Neo Kids for Giving Tuesday that year. I donated all the proceeds from a book sale that I did over a course of 2 weeks and gave that back to Neo Kids. So, so all that to say, you know, it's been a few years since I've been trying to find different ways, you know, to help raise funds, tie it into hockey. But I've been fortunate enough to be able to join the board, you know, over this past year and really get involved in a more, you know, formal and strategic way.
And I mean, your answer was perfect because it kind of resonated with me, and it's partly why we haven't had a podcast episode in, I don't know, what, Scott, 3 weeks?
Two, 3 weeks.
But last week, my 4-week-old daughter, she was in the pediatric ICU with RSV.
Oh.
But, you know, the hospital is 45 minutes from us. I also have twin 3-year-olds, so I'm staying home with them. My wife's at the hospital with their newborn, then she'll come home and I'll go there. So we're like always displaced. So, I mean, you're kind of, what you just said kind of resonated with me, just what I recently kind of went through.
Well, sorry to hear that. Hopefully, is it your 4-week? Is
4-week old daughter. Yeah. She's doing much better. Yeah.
She's doing much better. That's good. Yeah, that's thanks. Great to hear.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can tell you about my full-time job. I'm a firefighter paramedic, and there's nothing scarier than seeing a kid in distress. It's, you know, that's hard. That really is. So, you know, good for you, man, for doing that work, because, you know, that's wonderful what you're doing.
It really is, Mike.
Thanks.
But now that the season's going to be getting started back up here again anyways, and hopefully everything stays normal, any plans to get to a Kings game, say Toronto, Buffalo, anything like that?
I would love to. Yeah, I'd love to. It was one of those things that we were discussing, you know, before the pandemic happened. I think that was the year where I was going to try to either go down to Toronto to catch them there. The timing didn't work out with work, but like my goal was actually to go to LA and watch, you know, watch a game at Staples. So
very cool.
I don't think that's going to happen this year. That's still probably like another year away.
Yeah.
But I think obviously if things go well here in Ontario, and again, we're kind of, it's not necessarily trending, I think, in the most positive direction that we thought maybe 3 months ago. But ideally, I'd love to catch some Leafs games this year. It's been a while. The last NHL game that I went to was actually in Minnesota. The Wild hosted the Oilers, so at least I got to see, you know, Connor McDavid. There was a few fights that night, so it was a pretty exciting game. But that was the last time I've seen NHL hockey. So we'll see what happens this year. But obviously, if I can't get to a game, I'm just pretty excited to, you know, to watch the season start at probably a normalish time of the year, you know, for the first time in a while, and start to maybe feel, you know, that things are kind of getting back to normal.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Mike, kind of last question and we'll let you go, but just want to get your preliminary thoughts on predictions for the Leafs this year now that they're back in their normal divisions.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, it's funny because the Leafs don't typically have a problem in the regular season, right? So, like, I fully expect that, you know, obviously they're going to have more competition, you know, kind of being moved back into their traditional format. So, I think that they've got some stiff competition in that group, but I fully expect that they'll probably put together a pretty solid regular season campaign. Mm-hmm. It's obviously the playoffs when, you know, none of that matters anymore, right? It's the record that you kind of set, you know, each game, right? So, I mean, I think like most Leafs fans, you know, when they were eliminated in the playoffs, I joked, you know, if the Kraken were taking new fans, and, you know, I was obviously, you know, people were getting on my case that like I was a fair weather Leafs fan. But I mean, in reality, like I was just,
you're frustrated.
I'm frustrated. But like any dyed in the wool, like Leafs fan knows that like you're getting sucked back in next year, no matter what. Like people like to say, like, I'm done with the Leafs. I'm not watching Leafs anymore. You know, after a few months go by, like, you can't just, you know, pick up and root for another team. Like, unless, of course, something disastrous happened and you had to, like, just disavow the franchise. But I think, you know, playoff losses are one thing. So I think I'm I'm invested. I'm ready to get hurt again. So go Leafs, go.
It's kind of like Lucy and Charlie Brown on the football, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And this is going to be the year that she holds the football. And every year, you know.
And I hate to put you on the spot, but are they going to be able to re-sign Morgan Rielly?
Oh, I mean, yeah.
That's going to be a tough one.
I mean, I think if we've seen anything over the summer with the price of a free agent defenseman, like it's – that's going to be quite the payday that he's due for if you look at some of his contemporaries right now, right? So, I mean, I don't know how they're going to make that work. I mean, he's a great player. I've obviously loved his tenure with the Leafs, but certainly there'll be some other considerations. But I'll be interesting to see what they do with that. But I think certainly nobody thought, heading into the offseason that some of those prices we'd see for some of those defensemen certainly, I think, changes, what we thought Rielly would get, a year ago versus, what he's probably in line for now.
Yeah, and the amazing part is in a flat cap world, this all happened. That's the part that just blows my mind personally. I mean, but the good news is because it's still a flat cap world, maybe not every team can afford to throw him a $10 million AAV contract. So, maybe there's wiggle room to be had there. But
yeah, so no, it's going to be interesting. Yeah, because I mean, it's funny, last year you look at, the prices that they got TJ Brody. I think that now is obviously a great deal. Sure. But certainly, yeah, it's going to be, it'll be interesting. One thing you can say about the Leafs is they're never short on excitement. So whether it's good or bad, they always keep you on your toes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Mike, thanks a million for coming on and taking the time to be with us. We really appreciate this.
No, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
All right. Absolutely.
Thanks, Mike.
That was Mike Comito, author of Hockey 365, Daily Stories from the Ice. What a great guy. That was awesome.
That was awesome.
That was really, really cool. And I tell you, I like that idea you had about the tearaway calendar.
Yeah.
I would buy that in a heartbeat.
That's exactly, I had one. I had one for a Chicago Bears calendar that would come into the office every day. And it was either like a fact or a trivia question.
Yeah. Yeah. My dad had one of those when I was growing up. It was a general sports one. And he always used to get mad because I would like look ahead and I would always like tear the thing off on him. So he never knew what day it was. So. Yeah. He finally ended up hiding it for me. So,
but yeah, anyway, I know you got Russ coming in. I'm going to head out.
Hey, what's up, Kings fans? And welcome back to part two of our podcast. So we've lost Ryan. Ryan had apparently had an editor Shakespearean type things to do. So, but don't fret, because in his place, we have our other regular co-host coming on back for part two. He is known as the Prince of PDO. He is the Prince of Court, or the King of Corsi, I should say, but he's also the birthday boy. So I'm going to bring him in, Mr. Russell Morgan. What's going on, pal?
What's up, Scotty? Good to be back talking Kings hockey again.
Yeah, how was your birthday?
It was good. It was good. Got to go to the skills showcase on Saturday. That was a lot of fun. The Kings did a really good job. Getting the fans excited. I know the fans got a kick out of it, and some of the future stars got to show off their skills. And then went to the Dodger game that night, and the Dodgers got a victory over the Colorado Rockies. So all around good day. Good day.
Yeah, I saw that on your Twitter feed there. It looked like a great night.
Yeah, it was a great night. So always when you can see Kings and Dodgers in the same day, it doesn't happen too often. So that was pretty cool. I think that was probably the first time I've ever celebrated my birthday in Staples Center. Don't usually see the Kings on the ice in August, so that was pretty cool.
Well, that's cool. That's really cool. Yeah. And, speaking of cool, too, I just want to let everybody know before we get going here, our colleague, Ryan Cowley, who does tremendous work for us here at HockeyRoyalty.com, mm-hmm. his article is top-notch. Well, he's actually released a book. It's called All the Right Words, My Journey as a Sports Writer Who Stutters. And, best of luck to him. I'll tell you, to do what Ryan does is absolutely incredible. And his mm-hmm. book's available at Amazon, I think barnesandnoble.com, wherever you can find it. So if you want a great read, by all means, check this book out, because I'll tell you something. If you like Ryan's articles, you're going to love this book. You will not be disappointed. So with that said, looks like we've got some Kings news to talk about. A certain Mr. Russell Morgan himself got to attend development camp. So tell us, buddy, what did you see at development camp?
Yeah, I was there for a couple of days. I was there for the Wednesday afternoon session and a little bit of the Friday morning scrimmage. It was really cool. Just being able to see Kings hockey, I guess, is always a fun thing to see. There's a couple of fans there. So I'm sure they got a kick out of it also. But yes, a lot of good young players in the mix. And one side thing that I thought was really cool was Jared Stahl and Matt Green seemed like they were having a little bit more fun than the players were on the ice. But so that was pretty cool. But so a lot of good young stars. Andre Lee was kind of one of the big names that I thought, again, no pun intended, but one of the big names that kind of made a name for himself during camp. Big kid, seventh round pick in 2019. And when he's able to get the puck along those boards, it's hard to get away from him. I mean, he's got those Alexander Frolov skill set when in terms of protecting the puck along the board. So, and he had a nice little goal during 5-on-5 play on Wednesday, scoring top shelf, kind of got some oohs and ahs from the crowd. So that was pretty cool. And then another player that I thought that I was actually excited to see was Martin Kromiak. And he was a fifth round pick in that 2019 draft as well, or 2020, I'm sorry. But I've always been really high on him since the Kings drafted him. He's got really talented skill set, really fast skater. Once he gets going from blue line to blue line, it's hard to stop him. And he did a lot of those Pavel Datsyuk kind of takeaways that was pretty cool to see, where he was able to take the puck away in the defensive zone and then skate it all the way up to the blue line and try to make a play happen. So that's another player I'm really excited about. I know it started off with a little bit of unfortunate with Quentin Byfield having to leave the first day, and then Alex Turcotte having to go through emergency surgery. That was really unfortunate, but it sounds like they both will make a recovery. And the Kings had mentioned that Turcotte should come back for the rookie tournament in Arizona. And then I think the Quentin Byfield injury was more or less precautionary. So looking forward to seeing what they can bring, because it sounded like the Alex Turcotte especially was making a big impact in his first game back, or his first real kind of prove it scene back.
Yeah. I mean, Alex Turcotte actually had an emergency appendectomy. So
appendectomy, yeah.
He should be ready to go. And hopefully, like you said, Byfield is all precautionary with his foot. A couple questions. How do we not have hashtag Andre the Giant going yet?
I know, right?
It's
too easy almost, I would say.
I know.
It's pretty wild because, I mean, you see the pictures on the first couple days, and then when I got there on Wednesday, this is the first player I got to see because, I mean, everyone's talking about him. And then more, like, you see him, he's easily the most identifiable player on the ice, I mean, just from his size standpoint alone. So sure. He's got a lot of size, and if he's able to use it to his advantage, really, then he can be I project him maybe like a bottom six player in the NHL. I mean, you think of like a Jordan Nolan type player who was also a seventh round draft pick. I mean, he's got that skill set where he's got some hands and he's got some size that he can use. So it's a good player.
I mean, could you imagine, you know, a few years down the road, you have like Andre Lee, Samuel Hellenius. I mean, Vince McMahon will be scouting out Kings games.
Yeah, exactly. I know. It was the first, I mean, Hellenius and Andre Lee on the same line. I mean, they're just going to be, just put them two together. They can probably cover the whole ice with their wingspan.
I know, right? And, you know, you mentioned Martin Kromiak. He fell for whatever reason. I mean, there were some in the 2020 draft that had him projected to be a low first round pick, and he, for whatever reason, fell down to the fifth round and thank God into the Kings' laps. I do believe he's going to be returning to Kingston of the Ontario Hockey League this year, correct?
Correct. Yeah. He's going to be teammates with projected number one overall pick next season, Shane Wright. So that'll be a fun duo to watch.
That's going to be really fun. Mm-hmm. Anybody else stand out to you at development camp?
Well, I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about Brant Clark. I know there's a lot of talk about what Andre Lee did. Samuel Fagmo had a good camp, but Brant Clark, man, King's got a good one here. You don't want to make the comparisons to Drew Doughty, but they're there. I mean, when you're watching the ice and watching the players on the ice, and whenever a player makes a nice play or a nice defense, any type of nice play, the first player's voice you hear is Brant Clark cheering him up, hyping him up, sticks on the ice. And it's just, you hear that charisma that we've noticed from these press conferences actually on the ice translate to the ice as well. So, I mean, that's just a great skill set, or a great trait to have if you're a teammate on a team. And not just from a skill standpoint, I mean, he's great when he comes to making an impact. I mean, he knows when to jump into play offensively, and his defensive game is great. I mean, in the two-on-one drills I saw on Wednesday, he was breaking up duos and really handily, with like duos like Samuel Fagmo and Rasmus Kupari, Francesco Pinelli, and Martin Kromiak. I mean, the way he was using his edges and his stick to break up plays and then skate the puck out of his defensive zone was just incredible to watch. And I mean, it's hard to imagine the Kings giving him a chance to make an impact or giving him a couple of games this season, but I can see him making the Kings roster next year.
Yeah. I mean, that's, well, you know, chances are, I think he probably returns to his junior team this year in Barrie, but I mean, you never know. You might see him for 9 games towards the end of the season. You know, that option is still there, especially if, you know, Barrie doesn't advance very far or whatever happens. Mm-hmm. But you know, the thing about Brant Clark is too, you know, it's been talk in the Kings world over and over again for the past few months about, oh, we got to get a young dynamic left defenseman. Got to get a young dynamic left defenseman, right? And by the looks of things, the price tag on that young dynamic left defenseman is going absolutely through the roof. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're going to have to trade for him, it's going to cost you a boatload of, you know, prospects, draft capital. And then you're going to have to pay said player at least $9 million a season. So, you know, the thing is with Brant Clark coming along like he is and eventually, you know, making the Kings roster, hopefully, you know, as early as next season, to me, honestly, that kind of alleviates the need. I know they want somebody to, you know, dynamic and all that with Doughty and all that. But personally, I think they'll be just fine with having Mikey Anderson playing with Drew Doughty. You know, you break Brant Clark in, you know, say next season and put him with somebody like a Toby Bjornfort or whatever. Because if Bjornfort gets his playing time this year, that's going to be one more year of experience. So to me, it almost kind of cancels out the need to go overboard anyway. I'm sure eventually they would like to have a little bit more scoring from their left side. Mm-hmm. But, you know, with that said, it also kind of looks like the Kings have got a ton of defensemen all of a sudden as far as coming up through the ranks. So something is going to have to give here eventually. And it also looks like they've got a ton on the right side. So to me, it almost looks as though somebody's going to either have to move to the left side or they're going to have to make some deals.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said. And it's funny that you mentioned that a player would have to move to the left side who's on the right side. Because, I mean, we're looking at the prospect depth chart. We're talking about Drew Doughty, who's not going anywhere. Matt Roy, who I think they should hold on to, who's great talent. Sean Walker, who knows, that might be the player that the Kings potentially move. Brant Clark, Brock Faber, Helga Granz. There's just names that go down the line there. I mean, Jordan Spence, yeah, who also had a good camp. But, I mean, a player, if there's any player that I think would possibly have the potential to move to the left side, it's Brock Faber. And the reason I say that is because he's got a lot of comparisons to Alec Martinez, and that's something that Alec Martinez was able to do really easily. And with Brock Faber's skating ability, if he is able to move to the left side and play that position really well, that, I mean, that bodes really well for the Kings going forward and their defensive core going forward. But, I mean, it's funny because I think the Kings actually drafted one of their defensive pairings of the future in this past draft with Kirill Khersonov and Brant Clark. I mean, Khersonov is a player that is known for his defensive game, and you pair him with Brant Clark, who's known for his offensive game. So it's like you have a perfect match right here. And and the way Mark Giannetti was talking about Khersonov, it sounded like he's going to make an impact a lot sooner than later. So with my projection of having Brant Clark coming into the lineup possibly as early as next season, who knows? Maybe we see Khersonov with the Rain next season and maybe even with the Kings after that. So there's a lot to like about the Kings' defensive core.
Absolutely. And, you know, the nice thing about Khersonov is he's already got professional experience playing in the KHL. And he's not playing, you know, he's not one of those 6 to 8 minute a night guys. I mean, he's getting playing time. He's what they say he was averaging like 18 minutes a game last season, I believe it was.
Yeah, and, really good St. Petersburg team.
Yeah. And I mean, okay, so he's not an offensive powerhouse, but you know what? You don't need 6 offensive powerhouses on your defense. You have to have guys back there to defend, you know, because exactly. I mean, it kind of goes along with the name, right? Defenseman. So.
Yeah. If we look back at the past Kings defensive, I mean, when they won the Stanley Cup, I mean, you have players like Robin Reguerre, Matt Green, Willie Mitchell, like players that focused on defense, Rob Scuderi. That's what those players did. And they paired really well with those offensive Drew Doughtys or Alec Martinez of the game. So you need those players.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, I mean, just my opinion, but I don't think there's really any need to, you know, give up the farm, so to speak, to get that magical left young dynamic defenseman, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, and there's not really any available either. I mean, like you mentioned, it's like you hear the names floating around. I mean, we talked about possibly Rasmus Dahlin. It doesn't sound like he's going to be on the move. I mean, but I mean, like you mentioned, I know, much to your displeasure, but like you mentioned, like the price that you'd have to pay for. I mean, look at what Seth Jones of all people got. He got two first round picks and the contract that he got is just. I mean. The Kings should be lucky that they didn't have to dig into the prospect pool for any kind of deal. And just being able to acquire the players they did, like Victor Arvidsson and Philip Deneau, with giving them no high-end prospects at all. So,
Exactly. I mean, and really the only one that I could potentially see even being available, and he's not doesn't qualify under the young part of it, but Morgan Rielly, maybe, if the Leafs can't afford to re-sign him. But there and again, he's going to want to get paid because he's going to be hitting his first big UFA contract. And that's you're looking at, guess what, $9 to $10 million a year. And do you really want to pay that kind of money for Morgan Rielly? Personally, I don't think that'd be a good move for the Kings. But you know, I'm not Rob Blake, so I don't know. But we'll see what happens. So speaking of Kings defensemen, unfortunately, we have an injury to report. Kim Nosainen, a fourth-round pick for the Kings. I believe it was the 2018 draft. Looks like he's going to be out for 12 weeks, they're saying. I guess he had a collision with another player. So, obviously, he's going to recover, but he's going to miss about 3 months playing time. So, hopefully he'll come back strong. And, I don't know, potentially maybe see him with the rain next year. What do you think?
Yeah, it was an unfortunate injury with Nosainen. Kings. What was it? Fifth round pick in 2019. And he led his Liga team last year in points. And there's some really good comparisons that when looking at, he's got a 50% looking at hockeyprospects.com or hockeyprospecting.com. He's got a 52% NHL or probability. So he's got some good skill and he's really known as the kind of a offensive type defenseman. He's on the smaller side. But if you're looking at, closest comps right here, I'm thinking about like a Brendan Smith or Jake McCabe. So possibly seeing him with the rain next season. I believe he might still have a contract with the Liga team over there in Finland, but we'll see what happens next season.
Yeah. And you know what, you know, the more I think about that, if he does have another year with Liga, it might almost be better off for him to stay over there to play in that league, you know, because he's playing against, you know, men professionals, you know, whatnot, and then come over the following season. Because to be perfectly honest with you, it kind of looks like the rain are going to be loaded as well. Trying to, you know, so
where are you going to play him here? I mean,
fantastic problem coming here.
Yeah, exactly. I know, right? This is a great problem to have. But I mean, if you do bring him over here, there's not going to really be a lot of minutes. But if he's getting that the good quality playing time over there in the Liga, I mean, that's not a bad league to play in. I mean, it's known as probably the third best league in the world. So. And I believe he was also supposed to be one of the alternate captains for his team. So he's known as a he was supposed to be a really good impact player for them this season. So it was a big loss for that team, but he should be back in a couple months and hopefully he returns to form.
Well, and that's just, and you know, the fortunate part, I guess, if you could say the silver lining, so to speak, would be that he is going to be back this season. So, you know. Well, maybe our friends over at the Making It Rain podcast will be talking about him coming to the rain maybe next year. We'll see.
Yeah.
We'll drop the word. So one last news item for us to talk about. We were having a very interesting discussion about this yesterday. The Carolina Hurricanes have signed Jesper Kotkaniemi, to a 1 year.
You said that better than I would have.
You know what? Every time I hear that last name, I want to hear Barry Manilow singing it to the Colt Cabana. That's all, you know. But I'm not going to bother saying it. Don't worry about it. I won't scare everybody. But anyway, they signed him to an offer sheet. 1 year, $6.1 million. Now, I know you and I have very differing opinions on this, but I'll give you the floor first. Tell me why this is a good thing, Russ.
First of all, I think it's just hilarious. I mean, everything that Carolina did here is just like WWE, like totally like purely entertainment value. If you're just looking at it from that standpoint, I mean, you have to love everything that they did here. I mean, even the tweets after, they're tweeting it out in French. You know, Don Waddell's specifically quote by quote saying what they said, what the Canadian said when they offered Sebastian Aho I mean, it's just, I love it. So from a hockey standpoint, that's where I can see where your concerns are. But I mean, we're thinking about the Carolina Hurricanes. I mean, they're in a win now situation. They have a lot of 1 year deals on their books. They're looking to make that jump into an actual, like, legit Stanley Cup contender. They have a lot of talent, and I can see that making that jump. So there is an overpayment here. I believe some contract projections had him getting like just over $2 million for maybe a couple years. So $6 million for 1 year. I mean, if you're the player, like, why wouldn't you sign that deal? Like, I'm going to get everything I would in 3 years for 1 year. Sure, why not? And he's also getting going to have a time to sign another contract after next season. So, I mean, the Canadians are in a tough situation here. It's pretty much lose-lose for them, because for them to have to match this offer, that's going to put them even further over the cap, which they didn't want to be. Or if they don't sign him, then they lose a potentially good young forward that they were kind of hoping to have maybe in the future. Kotkaniemi, he isn't, hopefully I'm not butchering that name, he hasn't really lived up to the potential that he was supposed to be yet, but he's still only a 21-year-old center who, if you play him in maybe the right situation, could potentially live up to that potential. So I like it. I don't love what the Hurricanes did. I mean, I love what they did from an entertainment standpoint, but from a hockey perspective, I think it's a good move. I don't think it's a great move, but I do see why they did it.
Okay, so here's, you know, I mean, okay, the entertainment thing, whatever. I mean, that's Tom Dundon.
And the $20 signing bonus, Sebastian Aho's number, that's brilliant, brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, if that's how they get their kicks, then fine, whatever. I mean, that, you know, it is what it is. I couldn't even care less about that. But here's the thing, right? $6.1 million to this guy. And I understand he's 21, and I understand he was a number three overall pick, even though he was a tremendous overreach at number three, let's be honest. Okay. Yeah. So, yes, he can sign a new contract after this, but why would he? Why would he? Because to re-sign him as an RFA again, Carolina is going to have to give him another $6.1 million AAV contract, because that's a qualifying offer now. So, yeah, I get it. They pay him the $6.1 million. If he pans out, great, right? But if you're Kotkaniemi, why would you say, okay, well, here, I'll sign for 3 more years at $4 million per year, say, when he can turn around and say, well, no, you have to qualify me at $6.1 million. And if I have another great year, guess what? I'm going to make even more money. And if I don't, oh, well, but he's already made over $12 million more than he ever thought he was going to make in the process. And the other thing is, too, yes, this was all about trolling Montreal. Don't tell me that it wasn't. But where is he going to go? Or where is he going to play in this lineup? Because think about it. They got Aho. Jordan Staal's not going anywhere. They just signed Derek Stepan. Mm-hmm. So what are you going to do? Pay him $6.1 million to be your fourth line center? It just simply makes no sense. And if I'm Montreal, yeah, okay, it hurts. You know, he was a young player and he could develop into something. But it's not like they're not going to get anything out of this. They're getting a first round pick and a third round pick. And think about, and now this is always a risk, of course. But let's say Carolina's season goes down in flames. Say they get hit with a lot of injuries or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
That first round pick is not lottery protected. Let's just say that Carolina misses the playoffs. They just handed Montreal a lottery pick for somebody that has nowhere, does not even come close to living up to his potential. Not yet, anyway. I mean, I'll give you a little, and I just saw this on Twitter a little while ago, so I have to mention this, right? One of my favorite Twitter follows, West Coast Hockey Bias. He's hilarious. I love him, right?
he loves to disagree.
Yes, it's great.
But it's great. I love it.
He just tweeted out that Jesperi Kotkaniemi, and Austin Wagner both have 22 goals in 171 games. Mm-hmm. How would you feel about giving Austin Wagner $6.1 million for a year?
Yeah, that'd be tough. That'd be a tough spot to fill as well.
That's what I mean, right?
So I think this is kind of where, I mean, I've mentioned this before, but I think the Canadiens' run to the Stanley Cup Finals this past season was the flash in the pan.
That was smoke and mirrors.
Yeah, I think we all kind of maybe can agree on that. I know Canadiens don't think so, but I mean, this team wasn't projected to be as good as they were last season. They're still a young and almost kind of in the middle of a rebuild kind of team. I mean, they don't even really have their number one goalie, who's still in the prospect pipeline to back up Carey Price. The name is not on top of my head right now, but I mean, you look at their lineup right now. Nick Suzuki is still a young player. He's still developing. Yes, Barry Kotkaniemi is still developing. I mean, Shea Weber, I mean, now he's probably not even going to play anymore. I mean, so that the impact that players like that made, it almost elevated their value maybe a little too much to where now they can't really afford them, and they weren't really looking to have to pay that much money to some of these young players now. But so Carolina saw that angle and took it straight up.
Yeah, true. But you know what? If Kotkaniemi goes, it gives a young player like a Ryan Pulock a chance.
Yeah, that's another big
problem. So there's, it's not like they're going to be without. And not only that, with this signing, now Carolina just suddenly found themselves butted up against the cap. And by the way, if you're Andrei Svechnikov, how are you feeling right now? He's like, oh man, I just got $7.8 million a year. Yay. Wait a minute. This guy got $6.1 million. What's going on here? I knew I should have waited to sign that contract. But he did get 8 years out of it, so I guess he can't complain. But it's going to be interesting to see how it all works out. It really is. Again, if I'm Montreal, I say, you know what? It was nice knowing you. Good luck in Carolina. See ya.
Yeah, and I think that's what they have to do.
Third round pick and start rebuilding your prospect pool. Because you're right. I mean, let's face it. Montreal is not a Stanley Cup contender. Last year was a nice story. Nice Cinderella run. Great. But I don't think you're going to see that again this year. And honestly, I don't think Kotkaniemi makes a difference either way for them this year. So, you know, take the picks.
I agree. And I think that's it sounds like that's going to have to be the decision they make. Because, I mean, right now, I believe they're $2 million over the cap right now. So if you bring in Jesperi, then you're going to be $8 million over the cap. And that's, I believe, with Shea Weber's LTIR.
Yeah.
So, I mean, where do you go from there? I mean, they just have to wave and say sorry. But it'll be interesting when Carolina plays in Montreal to see how the Canadian fans welcome him back. That'll be a fun game to watch.
Yeah, but who could blame him for signing that contract, you know?
Oh, yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, the player, I mean, how can you be mad at the player?
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
This is just two teams that are dueling at each other now for the offer sheets that he's just in the middle of, but he's getting the most benefit out of it. It's like, okay, yeah, sure. If you want to give me $6 million to be the butt end of a joke, I'm cool with that.
Yeah, he's the guy who's playing scratch-off lottery tickets and just hit the big one. But I'll tell you, if Carolina really wanted to troll him, they should have waited until next year when Nick Suzuki hits RFA.
Oh, yeah, that would have
been. That's when they should have really saved it for.
Mm-hmm. I know, they're probably calling Nick Suzuki's agent right now saying, we need to sign you. We'll give you however much money you need.
We'll get rid of whoever. Don't worry.
Exactly. All their RFAs are going to be signed a lot earlier now, I'm sure.
Carolina's not going to have a first-round pick for the next 5 years, but that's okay. Yeah.
I guess this kind of goes into, I mean, a larger discussion around the league now of really what is an offer sheet at this point. I mean, right now, we always thought of offer sheets as dinosaurs, but now, I mean, now they're almost just like, if you really want to mess with the team, I mean, it's really about, you really need to offer sheet a player, because that's really, I mean, look at what it did to Carolina. They were so pissed off by it that they ended up paying a player three times the amount he was worth just to get the team back. So who knows how that's going to impact NHL going forward.
Yeah, and apparently they had been trying to trade for him. So they really see something in him. I guess Montreal just wasn't, you know, impressed with the package they were offering or whatever. So I don't know if it wasn't as impressive as a first and third round pick. I don't know what's going on. I'm sure that'll come out eventually, but
yeah. He's got some Finnish friends on the team as well. I mean, Aho's from Finland, Teuvo Teravainen, and also I believe he skates with them in Finland quite a bit. So I'm sure they saw that chemistry and wanted to have it in Carolina. So there's a lot of dynamics going on in Carolina with the signing of Tony DeAngelo and this.
Yeah.
And the whole, like, all the Caniacs. It's really a kind of a WWE kind of NHL franchise.
I just think it's funny that, you know, some of these people that think that, you know, they just signed, you know, Wayne Gretzky or something. It's
relax. Pump the brakes a little bit here.
Yeah, he was a healthy scratch in the playoffs. Okay, settle down, you know.
Right, yeah.
But you're right. That's a very interesting dynamic, because not only, you know, like you just mentioned, the D'Angelo signing, but Dougie Hamilton's gone. They let Alex Nedeljkovic. I can never say that name. Sorry, I know I butchered it. That's a Detroit, the goaltender. Okay, so yeah, it's a lot of moving parts. We'll see what happens. I mean, but like I said, I just personally, I would never have offered that offer sheet for him at that money. But I don't know. Maybe I can be proven wrong, but I don't think so.
You pay a little bit more to be funny in the NHL nowadays.
Yeah, right. Well, I guess we did need some entertainment value, and we certainly got it. Oh, boy. Well, buddy, I think that's about it. I think that's all we got for now. So I'm sure next time we talk, we'll have some more Kings news. Hopefully, anyways. Good news, by the way. Good news. But yeah. So it's been fun. I hope you enjoyed your birthday. And want to thank Mike Comito for coming on. And well, guys, that's all we got. So thanks for listening, and we will see you next week. And go Kings, go!